And we also welcome many distinguished guests from the legislature, from the Department of Education, from the government, and also the public. Justice Rechtenwald, at the end of the session, will recognize individually the many important and interesting people who are here to join us today. This event has been the work of the Supreme Court in partnership with the Judicial History Center and Matt Matisse, also in partnership with the William S. Richardson School of Law and the Hawaii State Bar Association Civic Education Committee. The event is also sponsored by an organization called Discover Law, which is a part of the Law School Admissions Council, and their goal is to bring diversity to the bar. And this was the dream of the law school's namesake, William S. Richardson, that the bar should look like the people of Hawaii. And I'm going to do one thing just slightly out of order, which is to recognize the alumni of Farrington High School who are attorneys. So if they could just wave real fast. It's a pretty impressive group of very distinguished people who actually, many of them, spend a lot of time giving back to the school. And so one part of today is that if any of you are thinking about being a lawyer or a professional of any kind, whether it's a veterinarian or a governor or whatever, and you think you're going to the wrong school with not so much resources or you have the wrong family, check it out. Those people did it. So pursue your dreams. When I step down from the stage, this is no longer Farrington High School auditorium. This is the Supreme Court, okay? So this is an official and actual hearing of the Supreme Court. It is the court. That means that all of the rules and the formalities of the court will take place. That means no talking. You must give the court your full attention. It means that when called, you will be asked to rise. It means there are no cell phones and no picture taking. So once again, welcome, and I think we'll begin. Thank you.
Please rise. Hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Good morning and aloha, everyone. The court is honored to be here today at Farrington High School as part of our first oral argument in our Courts in the Community program. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Tanaki, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes.
Okay, and Mr. Tsushima, you've asked for a 5-minute warning before the end of your argument. Is that correct? Very well, then, Mr. Tanaki, if you'd proceed.
May it please the court, Jack Tonaki, State Public Defender, on behalf of Steve C. Kabagbag, Jr., Chief Justice Rechtenwald, and Associate Justices of the Hawaii Supreme Court, it is indeed a high honor for me to appear before you this morning in this wonderful venue in this case of great importance to justice in our state courts. Mr. Kabagbag respectfully asks this court to rule that the Intermediate Court of Appeals committed grave error when it held in its summary disposition order that the Circuit Court did not commit plain error for failing to provide a specific jury instructions on the dangers of eyewitness identification testimony. Justices, modern technology and scientific advancement have proven what many have long suspected about the criminal justice system. That is that certain aspects of our system are very susceptible to mistake. Eyewitness testimony is the most powerful and at the same time the most dangerous kind of evidence. It is powerful for obvious reasons, justices. That moment when a victim comes face to face with the accused and points a person out in the courtroom is often the most memorable in any trial. It is dangerous evidence because it is now beyond dispute that this type of evidence has been shown to be the most vulnerable to error. In the recent U.S. Supreme Court case of Perry versus New Hampshire, Justice Sotomayor wrote in her dissent, quote, "The empirical evidence demonstrates that eyewitness misidentification is the single greatest cause of wrongful convictions in this country. Researchers have found that a staggering 76% of the first 250 convictions overturned due to DNA evidence since 1989 involve eyewitness misidentification."
If I might interrupt you, Mr. Tanaki. The eyewitness in this case was a police officer, and I see in your opening brief you're concerned that because the identification was made by a police officer that the jury might give untoward influence or favor, and I'm troubled by that, and that it seems to me that a police officer is more trained than a lay witness as far as evaluating physical characteristics and making identification. What is your response to that?
Justice Duffy, that is correct, that it is our fear on the defense that a witness in a uniform, such as a police officer, would be given perhaps greater weight than a lay witness, because the impression that everyone gets is they're more trained toward the identification of a person or to look for certain characteristics. However, in this very case, it was illustrated that this police officer was susceptible to the same mistakes as any other eyewitness. The description that he sent out on the All Points Bulletin was simply local male dark clothing. There was no identifying marks, there was no description as to height and weight, there was no other description other than this local male dark clothing that supposedly police officers are trained to observe.
Mr. Tanaki, that came out in cross-examination. Didn't, in this case, the system work as it was envisioned in our earlier cases, which is that through cross-examination, through argument, defense counsel would be able to make exactly the kind of points that you just made and then leave it to the jury to decide how much credibility to afford, in this case, a police officer's testimony?
It did come out through cross-examination, but it's our position today that simply through the traditional, or I should say the means for evaluating eyewitnesses that has been already set forth in the precedents in the state, that becomes now at this point insufficient. It's our position, Mr. Chief Justice, that the jury has to be informed about the particularized dangers of mistaken eyewitness identification.
Well, and Mr. Tanaki, in this case, the police officer said that he shone his flashlight right into the defendant's face and the defendant froze. So the police officer had a perfect view of the defendant's features. And so isn't that something that we leave up to the jury in terms of the jury deciding who to believe and what to believe?
It is, Justice Acoba. And a determination which is within the province of the jury. However, it's our position that the jury has to be sensitized to the dangers of mistaken eyewitness identification. And in fact, the Perry versus New Hampshire case, implicitly, we would argue this morning, has mandated that a specific jury instruction be given on eyewitness identification, because in the majority opinion, the it was written that in Perry, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to order that a witness's identification of a man trying to break into cars be suppressed, because the circumstances under which the man was identified was not a police-arranged suggestive process. But in so holding, Justice Ginsburg wrote that, quote, when no improper law enforcement activity is involved, we hold it suffices to test reliability through the rights and opportunities generally designed for that purpose. Notably, the presence of counsel at post-indictment lineups, vigorous cross-examination, which occurred, of course, in our case here, protective rules of evidence, and I will emphasize, jury instructions on both the fallibility of eyewitness identification and the requirement that guilt be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. So Perry, in their majority—
Mr. Tanaki, you referred to Justice Sotomayor, but she wrote the sole dissent in the case, isn't
yes.
that correct? And so she, and are you advocating the barring of any eyewitness identification evidence in criminal trials?
You mean the barring of any improper eyewitness identification?
Well, I'm asking you, because if you read Justice Sotomayor's opinion, she cites to all these empirical studies which seem to indicate that eyewitness identification is not trustworthy evidence. So
yes.
Is that your position too?
Yes, it is. That potentially it is not, it's not trustworthy without being completely tested by all of these events in a criminal trial, such as cross-examination as well as a specific instruction to the jury regarding factors that jury has to consider in evaluating the eyewitness identification.
Mr. Tanaki, in
yes.
Perry, didn't the defendant want a pretrial adjudication by the judge as to the reliability of the witness testimony?
We did not file a pretrial.
In Perry it did, right? But
in
here
Perry,
you're,
yes.
you're asking the us to find plain error for the court not having given an identification instruction, is that correct?
Yes.
What about a point that Mr. Tsushima brings up in his brief, that what if the defendant doesn't want, what if your defense is other than an misidentification? Would it still be error for the judge not to give an identification instruction?
I think that with the standard being that it's the trial duties, it's the trial court's duty to correctly instruct the jury, it would be our position that if there is any evidence which indicates that eyewitness identification is a factor in the prosecution, that the jury be so instructed, regardless of what the defendant wants.
Wouldn't that put a defendant who wants to make the choice of relying on a particular defense, which might be in a case that perhaps duress or some other defense other than identification, of having to have the jury instructed on two conflicting theories, and in that way, perhaps in that defendant's or his attorney's point of view, undercutting his credibility with the jury?
I don't think that that's a danger, Mr. Chief Justice, because the jury would simply be instructed on that, and the defendant would be free to argue or to advocate for his or her defense. That often occurs with respect to other jury instructions.
Mr. Tanaki, in this case, you did not ask, or your office did not ask for an instruction. So how can you justify asking us now to require the court to have given that instruction when you didn't ask for it at trial?
I understand that, Justice Acoba, and the response that I have to give to that is it still remains the, under State versus Nichols, the trial court's duty to correctly instruct the jury. We are just arguing, we're not just arguing, but we're arguing this morning that because this issue has been taken up by the court, we feel that it is a timely issue and that the previous standard where it's within the discretion of the court to give a specific instruction on eyewitness identification is no longer sufficient.
And as you say, in 1976, this court held in State versus Padilla that it was discretionary with the trial court to give such an instruction. What has changed since 1976?
I think, Justice McKenna, a lot has changed. And this is, I think that the U.S. Supreme Court has wrestled with this issue in a whole line of cases, from Stovall to Neal v. Biggers, and all of these cases dealing with the various aspects of police procedure and eyewitness identification. And quite frankly, the research has caused many of the courts to change their views on what should be required in the jury instructions.
Do you know how many states require the giving of an instruction?
I don't have a count on the states, but in one of the footnotes in Perry versus New Hampshire, there were a whole line of states that currently have standardized criminal jury instructions. And I might add, Justice McKenna, that we don't even have in this state a standardized jury instruction on eyewitness identification. And part of the reason for this is because the jury instruction committee has declined to take up this issue. And it's our feeling that there needs to be, at this point, some mandate or an order from an appellate court in our state in order to get courts moving on this issue, because the jury instruction committee hasn't taken it up. I personally sat on the jury instruction committee for 10 years, and trial courts are frankly hesitant to give these instructions. If you look at
Tanaki, the Chief Justice asked you about the situation where the defendant doesn't ask for it or doesn't want the instruction.
Yes.
If that were the case, then what should the standard be in terms of when the trial court should give the instruction, even over, say, the objection of the defendant?
In our brief, Justice Acoba, we stated a standard that whenever eyewitness identification plays a critical part in the prosecution's case, it should be given. That standard came out of State versus, I believe it's State versus Long in the Utah case that we cited. But in retrospect, when we looked over that standard, we realized that standard may be quite vague one. So I think that we would advocate that the normal standard for the giving of an instruction. So if there's any evidence of an eyewitness identification, no matter how weak, that the court give such a specialized instruction.
And you are suggesting that the defendant cannot waive the giving of such an instruction?
Under the current standard, if this court were to rule that this type of instruction must be given, then I cannot envision a case where a defendant could waive that, because the court would still rule that they are obligated to give it under the standard for giving a instructing the court that, instructing the jury correctly.
Mr. Tanaki, even if we agree with you that such an instruction should perhaps be crafted by the jury committee and provided, at least in certain cases going forward, wasn't the failure to instruct here harmless because the jury, in fact, was adequately, its attention was, in fact, drawn to the identification issue, and the court did everything it was supposed to do under our existing case law. So, again, why would we not perhaps just give this instruction prospectively but affirm the conviction here?
Mr. Chief Justice, it's our position that it was not harmless in this case because the central question in whether an error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt is, was there a reasonable possibility that the error contributed to the conviction? And we believe that in this case, there was such a reasonable possibility because Officer Tumingbaum, the one that was involved in the identification, was the only witness to point out Mr. Kabagbag as the person involved in the theft of the equipment and the unauthorized control of the vehicle in this case.
If I might interrupt you, Mr. Tamaki, but would you agree that the identification issue was the sole issue presented by the defense?
Yes.
So everything focused on that. So the defense counsel, from my reading of the record, focused on it in opening statement and then in its cross-examination, the prosecution witnesses, and again in closing argument. And it seems to me that where it's the sole issue, it's very difficult for you to say that giving the cautionary instruction would have changed the result. It seems like the whole focus of this trial was on identifying. And do you have any evidence that would controvert what the police officer testified to as far as what he saw?
Well, the evidence that I was just going to say, Justice Duffy, that the eyewitness identification by this officer was the only evidence tying the Mr. Kabagbag to the truck in this case. There were no fingerprints. There were no there was no other tangible or observable evidence that no other witnesses. So there was a single witness in this case which tied our client to the truck.
How about the circumstances of his discovery lying face down in a ditch in a residential area at 1:15 in the morning in the vicinity where the truck was found? Wouldn't that be corroborating evidence?
That would be some circumstantial evidence. However, again, the description of the person involved that was given by the officer was very vague and could have applied to any number of local males in the area. And in fact, the process that Officer Tumingbaum used is very susceptible to misidentification because he said, this is on page 138 of the May 18th transcript. It's a little troubling. The Officer Tumingbaum said that he gives a broad description so that other officers in the area can apprehend a potential suspect in the area. So if I get out of this what the officer is saying, that he gives as broad or as vague a description as possible so that other officers can detain any person that could fit that description in the area. This whole process, if that's a process that HPD uses, and this is the first I've heard of such a process, it would be very troubling indeed, and
isn't
would lend
point,
itself
isn't
to
the point. Excuse me, of instruction, because instruction, as Mr. Tsushima points out, could go either way. It could benefit the police actually, or the state, or it could benefit the defendant. So, isn't the issue here that what we want are reliable results and an appropriate instruction that calls the attention of the jury to factors that have been identified as important in invalidating eyewitness testimony should be given to the jury. There may be other circumstantial evidence that would tie the defendant to the case, but in terms of the identification of the accused, that if we want reliable results in our cases, then as a matter of course, identification is, as you said, the prime issue. That instruction should be given.
I think, Justice Acoba, that that is exactly what we're arguing this morning.
So the, how do you answer the objection, then, that in this particular case, it was harmless error not to give the instruction?
Well, the way that I answer that is that the circumstances under which this identification was made was very susceptible to mistake by even this police officer. And, you know, had a jury been given this instruction and looked into these factors, that perhaps a different result is gained here, and a more reliable result.
Mr. Tanaki, yes. I have a problem with the new standard that you've set forth this morning. Suppose there was a spouse abuse case, and the defendant's defense was mutual affray. But the victim's spouse still has to identify the other spouse as the perpetrator.
Yes.
Wouldn't that be ridiculous to have an eyewitness identification instruction in that kind of a case, when you have said that you think any evidence of eyewitness identification warrants the instruction?
Well, the jury would receive such an instruction, but just like other potential instructions that could be given in a case, it may not play a factor in the defense. So that wouldn't prohibit the defendant from arguing that it was self-defense or mutual fray.
Even when a spouse is identifying the other spouse, you think eyewitness instruction is appropriate?
Well, one of the factors one of the usual factors that's stated is in any eyewitness identification instruction is the familiarity or the prior familiarity that the eyewitness has with the person that was identified. So certainly, and I think that comes back to Justice Acoba's question, that oftentimes it will not be an issue because the prosecution will have at their disposal this instruction and will go through some of the factors, and it will actually maybe work sometimes to the favor of the state rather than the defense. But it remains our argument that we could go with the if it plays a critical part in the defense of the prosecution, the eyewitness identification, but that becomes a standard which is vague, and we feel that it might lead to more litigation over what constitutes a critical part of the prosecution. Is it that the...
Mr. Tanaki,
yes.
Are you familiar with the Henderson case out of New Jersey that was decided this year?
I'm not familiar with that case.
In that case, the court used the proposition that if the eyewitness identification was central to the case, then the court should give it. And in that case, also the court said it didn't matter whether the defendant requested the instruction. How do you respond to that?
That's a potential standard that could be used, but again, it'll become issue with probably leads to more litigation. What's a central part of the defense, a misidentification? Oftentimes in cases, as the court knows, There are a lot of gray areas. Oftentimes, the defense will consist partly of misidentification or partly of reasonable doubt or some other factors. So in using the standard that we currently have for jury instructions, I think it becomes an easier determination for the trial courts. And that's why, you know, we moved away from what we initially argued in our brief. I notice, Mr. Chief Justice, I'm out of time, so if I can summarize. In summation, Justices, the issue we raised today is only one of the ways in which we can address the problem is mistaken identifications in our jury system. I want to emphasize that it is not a total fix. Many of the current procedures used by police to identify perpetrators of crimes have been openly questioned by research on the human frailties involved in those identifications. Efforts to reform those procedures are also underway. However, the jury instruction issue is one reform which is in control of the court. I respectfully request that you hold that the intermediate court gravely erred, vacate the conviction of the trial court in this case, and remand Mr. Kabagbag for a new trial. Thank you,
Mr. Tanaki. Mr. Tsushima.
Good morning, Chief Justice. May it please the court. Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Stephen Tsushima on behalf of the state of Hawaii. Henry Louis Mencken, an American journalist, once said, quote, "For every complex problem, there is an answer that is clear, simple, and wrong," end quote. To be clear, the complex problem which I speak about is not misidentification, but the construction of a proper jury instruction with regard to eyewitness identification. Eyewitness identification is not a perfect science. A cautionary instruction is not the remedy. There's no scientific evidence in this.
If I might interrupt you, Mr. Tsushima. Yes, would you agree that eyewitness identification will always be subject to human error? There's always a chance for human error.
Sure.
So if that's true, why not try to eliminate as much human error as we can by giving the cautionary instruction that Mr. Tanaki requests us to do?
Well, I'll get late to, and not to avoid your question, I will get into it into the body of my argument, but it's a little complex in formulating a proper instruction. When you look at the studies and law review articles and the social science psychology studies, there are many factors that play a role with the memory and retaining the details that they study when a person identifies or tries to retain their identification of another person. When we're listing factors, like the Biggers Court did, of things that, say, a court could look at in trying to figure out the reliability of the identification, with each of those factors are multiple factors that it's going to depend on the person, their age, their gender, and their personal life experiences, that's going to affect each of those factors. It becomes difficult, and I will get to it more later, to just lay out factors that are going to appropriately and not misguide the jurors. So I will get more into that in a minute, Justice.
Well, Mr. Tsushima, don't you have an uphill battle? I mean, you cited Biggers, and one of the factors in Biggers is the court says that you should place some confidence in people who are confident in terms of their accuracy, or in terms of their identification. But the scientific studies seem to go the opposite way, that people who are confident really are poor gauges of accuracy. So how do you answer something like that? We have all this empirical evidence that faces the court. Shouldn't the court be doing something?
Thank you, Justice Scobo, for that question. It's that one factor that you did point out in the study that pointed out as to the confidence and how I believe what the study says is it does not have a direct correlation to what's the word I'm thinking of? It does not have a correct correlation to accuracy. There are also conflicting studies that show that a level of confidence is correlated to a high level of accuracy in identification. And that hits at the heart of what I'm trying to point out is that these studies are complex. They're fluid. They change constantly. They try to update. I think the Henderson Court, which Justice Acoba pointed out earlier, that court had assigned, and I think that was the New Jersey Supreme Court, had assigned I forgot what title they gave him. It was a master something to put together this meta-analysis where he looked at the studies for the past 25, 30 years, and he came up with 200 articles on the subject of eyewitness identification. And amongst those 200 articles, or in doing his research, he also came across 2,000 studies which actually used people from the community engaged in these experiments of memory and identification. And when you read State v. Henderson, it's a real complex process, and there are multiple studies out there that conflict with each other. And there's a difficulty in bringing all this research together and looking at the factors and deciding which studies are the ones that this court would want to go with, or this court would feel comfortable saying, yeah, this one correctly breaks down the factor of how it applies to the accuracy of identification. And that's the way the jury should be looking at it. To further address your question, Justice Acoba, it also goes to what a lot of the cases in the jurisdictions that have adopted a requirement that the eyewitness-specific jury instruction should be submitted. One of the jurisdictions, Utah, and several others, are recognizing that jury instructions have not been proven to be effective. And it's actually what they're looking at, and I don't want to go off subject here, but they seem to be looking at the expert witness to be the proper person to educate the jurors as to how each of these factors in fact apply to the case or to the individual who has testified in properly applying the factors, so that there isn't a mistaken understanding of how the factors actually apply to memory. And what these studies have also shown is that the research and in the jurisdictions where they had found that jury instructions should be required is that the current research showed that it hadn't been effective in aiding the jurors in spotting misidentifications.
How do you determine effectiveness? How did these studies determine effectiveness?
I don't know what they used.
How do they know whether it was effective or not?
I'm not sure if the studies looked at the actual cases, or I'm not sure what processes they came to the conclusion. I will say it came from the Law Review article, How Shall They Be Known, Dalbert v. Merrill Dow, Pharmaceuticals and Eyewitness Identification. I admit I'm not an expert on the social sciences or these studies that they're doing. I try to absorb as much as I could in reading these review articles and the studies which they conducted. Fortunately, the most I could gather from these courts is, and could tell this court is that it is a complex process. And well,
even if it's complex, you know, in this case, unlike some of our earlier cases, the Ving case and the Pahio case, this court didn't even instruct the jury that they had to find identification beyond a reasonable doubt. So absent an instruction of that kind, how can we be sure that the jury's attention was, in fact, adequately focused on this identification issue through the court's instructions?
Through the court's general instructions?
Well, yes, because the general instructions here, unlike the instructions in the Ving case and the Pahio case, didn't instruct the jury that they had to that the government had the burden of proving identification beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right. It still had in the general instructions the state's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that defendant committed the crimes. In the same way, I don't think there's any reasonable possibility that these jurors did not read that to mean that the state had to prove that, if in fact, it was defendant that committed the crimes.
If you read the general instruction, though, the general instruction goes to credibility of the witness. And here we're not concerned with credibility. We're concerned with the foundation for accepting the accuracy of the eyewitness identification. So in that sense, the general instruction doesn't take care of whether or not the identification should be trusted or not. Because the question is not, a truthful person could be mistaken. And the instruction would only go to the jury's assessment of the witness's testimony as to its truthfulness. So doesn't that leave out the question of how reliable the identification was?
Yes, I agree in part. As to the credibility instruction not being enough, part of the credibility instruction that's also submitted as a general instruction, and in fact was submitted in this case, doesn't just cover credibility, but also how the jury is to look at the weight of the testimony. And in this case, there are 33 pages of jury instructions that were submitted. And on page 9 of that jury instruction, of the jury instructions that the jury was able to take back with them in deliberations, on page 9, they look at the weight of the testimony, and the court lays out how the jurors should look at it. Now, I didn't hear opposing counsel mention any factors that he would propose to be submitted to the jury. What I have seen in a lot of the cases where the other jurisdictions have required eyewitness specific jury instruction, they've asked for these factors: the opportunity of the witness to view the person, the witness's degree of tension, the accuracy of the witness's prior description, the length of time elapsed between the observation and subsequent identification, the level of certainty.
Mr. Tsushima, excuse me.
Yes.
Would you agree that a identification instruction should be given under appropriate appropriate circumstances?
No, Your Honor, I do not.
So your position is you would never agree to an eyewitness identification instruction?
I think what I would not, in looking at the law review articles and the research that has been done, that on the difficulty of actually laying out factors that are not going to be misleading to the jury, to the extent that this court...
Are you suggesting that the United States Supreme Court should not have said that eyewitness-specific jury instructions, which many federal and state courts have adopted, likewise warn the jury to take care in appraising identification evidence? Isn't that one of the factors that was used by the Perry versus New Hampshire court?
Yes, it was one of the things that they looked at that were safeguards for the court to use. I do acknowledge that. Maybe I did misspeak. I should say from the front, from the get-go, that Perry did not require the instruction to be given by any means. They listed, I think, 6 factors that Mr. Tanaki already pointed out, so I won't restate them. But many
they
of those factors...
They listed 3 safeguards: the right of confrontation, effective assistance of counsel, which includes cross-examination, and the giving of an eyewitness identification instruction, did they not, as the safeguards?
Correct. And amongst those are rights and requirements. And in the court's acknowledgement that there are some courts that have required this and logically some courts that haven't, if they meant for it to be a requirement or that it was, as opposing counsel has stated, mandated, that would have been the perfect time for the court to say it's mandated. This should not be something that only certain courts are doing. Every court in this jurisdiction should be doing it.
They came pretty close to it, though, didn't they? Because the American Psychological Association had submitted an amicus brief, and you said that there are studies that say court instructions are not effective, but they say that in the context of saying we shouldn't allow eyewitness identification, period, because nothing works in court. But didn't the court say we also take account of other safeguards built into our adversary system that caution juries against placing undue weight on eyewitness testimony of questionable reliability? So wasn't the court statement in response to, or could we read it in response to, the American Psychological Association's amicus brief that said we shouldn't accept eyewitness identification evidence?
I do remember the Perry Court stating these safeguards at least twice, I believe, in their opinion. So I don't recall it being in response to, as you noted.
They don't expressly say that, but the right. American Association did submit an amicus brief.
Oh, I see.
And Justice Sotomayor cites to those studies in her dissent.
Oh, correct, yes. When I was referring to the reference that the court made, I was referring to the majority's reference to those factors, and that it did not state the eyewitness instruction to be a requirement by any means. And that clearly, if it had, that was the perfect time to say it, because they knew that there are some jurisdictions that have made a requirement and some that didn't. So clearly the Perry Court, as it relates to this case, did not make it a due process requirement for the jurisdictions, amongst the jurisdictions, and left it.
I didn't research all of the instructions they cited to that statement, but they include those states that do require it. Mm-hmm. Kansas requires it, and you mentioned Utah and right. New Jersey. They all require it. It's not a matter of discretion. And those are instructions U.S. Supreme Court cited to.
Correct.
Yeah. So what is your position in light of that?
With regard to what?
To the outcome of this case.
How Perry should affect the outcome of this case?
Whether an instruction should be required by this court in cases where eyewitness identification is a central issue.
I believe if this court is going to say that an instruction should be given, there should be a great pause and great care in constructing those factors that the court is going to be instructing the juries they must take into consideration, or as some of the instructions had stated, should take into consideration or may take into consideration. When I've looked at the vast majorities of the jurisdictions that did require an instruction, they were these five or six basic factors to look at. And what I was going to point out was that in on page 9, with the weight of the testimony, that goes not just to the credibility of the witness, but the weight of the testimony, it draws the jury's attention to look at the evidence in that manner. Now, I wish I had prepared a PowerPoint to show you guys, because it'd be easier to follow along. But I'm going to try to point out what I mean. In jury instruction number 9, which was given to the jury in this case and given as a general instruction in all criminal cases, one of the things that the court is instructing the jury to look at is the witness's means and opportunity of acquiring information. On much of these eyewitness instructions, they ask for the opportunity the witness had to view the person who committed the offense at the time the offense was committed and the witness's degree of attention. This sort of analysis can be covered under the instruction of the means and opportunity of acquiring the information, including the identification of the defendant. Another one of the factors, which actually is more covered in the general instruction than it is in the proposed instructions or the required instructions in the other jurisdictions, is the accuracy of the witness's prior description. So for the jury to look at the accuracy of the prior description with the subsequent identification. The jurors are already, and in this case, were instructed to look at the extent to which the witness is supported or contradicted by other evidence. The extent to which the witness has been contradicted by statements which in trial, whether in trial or at other times, meaning as preliminary hearings or statements to the officers. They're instructed to look at inconsistencies or discrepancies in the testimony of a witness may or may not cause you to discredit such testimony. In weighing the effect of the inconsistencies or discrepancies, whether they occur within one witness's testimony or as between witnesses, and consider whether they consider matters of importance or only matters of unimportant detail. And then there's a catch-all that's usually given with the proposed or the required eyewitness-specific jury instruction, and that's all of the circumstances surrounding subsequent identification procedure. And in this case, they're instructed all other circumstances surrounding the witness and bearing upon his or her credibility. And I do acknowledge that that refers to credibility.
If I might interrupt you, Mr. Shin, and you may have said this earlier, but I'd like a clarification. What is your position about there's no instruction as far as the state's burden of proof that the identification of the defendant as the person responsible for the crime? That's a little different from the factors we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. But shouldn't there have been an instruction requiring that as an element of proof?
And my position on that would be that the instruction with regard to proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, that there's no reasonable possibility that the jurors read that and did not see it and did not read that to mean that in order to find defendant guilty, the identification would have to be that it was defendant, that it's read the same way. There's no way that they read that and thought, well, that identification may be wrong, but all the other evidence is okay, he's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, that's the inference that you're making, but wouldn't it be better to give the jury the choice by telling them directly they would have to make that decision that this defendant is the person that committed the crime?
I think it'd be a more specific way of otherwise expressing the same conclusion. So I would say it's a...
So you wouldn't have an objection to that instruction?
If that was the sole instruction, that was additional? No.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, what was the sole instruction that you would accept?
That it's the state's burden to prove the identification of defendant beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, when I made the comparisons with what was actually the instructions given to the jury and what typically is the eyewitness-specific jury instructions, the difference then remaining is the length of time that elapsed between the observation and subsequent ID or show up, and the level of certainty demonstrated by the witness in the identification procedure. Now, when you apply those two, missing or instructions factors that were not given in this case, and you apply it to this case, well, the length of time between the observation that was done previously and the subsequent identification in this case was a mere matter of minutes. I believe the testimony showed it was somewhere between 10 and 13 minutes.
Mr. Tsushima, I'm sorry. Was eyewitness identification central to the conviction in this case?
Yes, it was.
You are then suggesting that if eyewitness identification is central to a conviction, the court should rely on expert witnesses rather than instructions, is that correct?
Perhaps I did misspeak. I was making references to what the law review articles and those social science studies had suggested and what they believe would solve the otherwise misguidance that a improper jury instruction provides. So they were taking the position that the expert testimony would be the proper way of dealing with that problem.
So is it the state's position that even where eyewitness identification is central in a case, a eyewitness identification instruction should never be given?
And maybe if I did say those words, maybe I misspoke, because what I meant to say was that if one is to be given, and it could, there is a case where, there is an instance where it should be given, but the problem being is that formulating the proper factors for the jury to look at without misguiding them and leading them to an improper conviction or false beliefs is going to be difficult.
So is the state conceding that perhaps an appropriate instruction should be given if eyewitness identification is central?
I think from what I'm looking at is that it would be difficult to form an appropriate jury instruction given the
studies. One of the things that we requested in the oral argument notice was that if this court were to require an instruction, that the parties be prepared to discuss the contents of such an instruction.
Correct.
What does the state believe should be the contents of such an instruction? Have you looked at the other model instructions? Have you seen one that you think is better than the others?
Yes, I have, Your Honor. If this court were to follow the other jurisdictions which switch from a discretionary to a required, I would propose that, or I would not have an objection with the what I'm going to refer to as generally the bigger factors that they pointed to. It's the same factors that the court looks at when the motion to suppress the identification is filed by the defense and the trial court considers. So I would have a hard time.
The Biggers factors were already set out in Padilla, weren't they?
Correct.
So that doesn't change anything. The Biggers factors, and we said earlier in oral argument that one of the Biggers factors has been proven to be inaccurate by the empirical studies. So Biggers in and of itself then would be defective.
Ineffective or?
Defective.
Effective. It goes to what I was originally saying as to it becomes complex. I was trying to address Justice McKenna's question is that I did realize that I was supposed to be prepared to discuss.
Let me ask you another question. You were just going over, how did you select those factors to apply to the facts?
Those were the factors that
And so are they helpful in assessing the facts, say as in the Kabagba case? Would those factors be helpful in assessing the facts?
Well, if we're going to look at the factors that the Telfair case said the court should look at, which is the proof, the contentions made, and the general instructions.
By citing them and discussing them, you indicate that they would be helpful to the jury?
It'd be helpful for our discussion. It goes back to the heart of my argument is that it's just a complex problem to try to correct.
It may be complex, but it's something that faces us and that we would have to deal with. And apparently other states have dealt with it, even though it is complex. But if it's helpful for us in our discussion, wouldn't those factors then also be helpful to the jury in assessing the facts before?
It doesn't appear so, because in those jurisdictions that adopted the notion that it should be required, acknowledged that it hadn't been helpful, that it could mislead the jury, and that the expert witness is the one who could, where relevant or where appropriate, be the one to properly point to the factors that
wouldn't
the jury...
Wouldn't it be more accurate to say those courts determine that the jury instruction alone isn't sufficient, that there might be other means that need to be taken? Because they haven't abandoned the jury instruction.
That's correct. They haven't abandoned. I guess, yeah, I should say the research that they cited to seem to point that that's not the proper remedy. And they were the ones, actually, that it was the review articles that said that it hasn't been proven to be effective.
Mr. Tsushima, your time, I guess we have a few more minutes for your argument?
That's correct, Your Honor.
A couple minutes. So at this point, if you'd like to wrap up.
Thank you.
Could I ask?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, just so in Henderson, Warren, and Long, the court specifically said that expert testimony was not enough to overcome inaccuracies of people's belief about identification testimony. And that's why they adopted these required instructions. So are you saying that those jurisdictions have retreated from that position?
From their original position?
Their position was that an instruction was necessary because all of these other things, cross-examination, general instructions, argument, and expert witnesses weren't working. Are you saying they retreated from that position?
I don't know if they've retreated from their position so much as they're acknowledging the research that has been done to show that those instructions, in fact, may have been misguided. I think they do acknowledge that by citing to those very references that say that, and I believe one of the journal articles went so far as to say, the courts that misunderstand the relevant psychological literature may be unwittingly contributing to wrongful convictions. And that's what they're noting, is that maybe we have to look at this a little more, that these instructions may be misleading the juries and not actually providing the protection that we had thought they were going to provide. That maybe the issue of the day is expert witness testimony in properly aiding the jury. If I may conclude, misidentifications. While the state acknowledges Hawaii is not immune from eyewitness misidentifications, defendant has not presented any data or information for this court to conclude that misidentifications are now a pervasive problem in this jurisdiction. To be certain, many jurisdictions like this one have not embraced the notion that special eyewitness jury instructions are required. Indeed, social science research has shown that not only are eyewitness-specific jury instructions ineffective to the jury to spot misidentifications, but courts that misunderstand the relevant psychological literature, as I just said, unwillingly contribute to wrongful convictions. Lastly, in this case, there's no serious question about the reliability of the identification. When this court looks at the facts of this case, the state is confident that it will find that the facts support affirming the conviction. And if this court does abandon its discretionary approach to eyewitness-specific jury instructions, the state asks that such holding be applied prospectively. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tsushima. Mr. Tanaki, any rebuttal? How much time does Mr. Tanaki have? 2.5 minutes, Mr. Tanaki.
2.5 minutes. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I just wanted to correct a statement. That standard of giving the instruction when it's a critical part of the prosecution's case, that came out of State versus Warren, the Kansas state, Kansas case. Not, I think I said State versus Long, the Utah case, but that's cited in our opening brief. As far as suggested language, there's not time for me to read the entire instruction that I came up with, but I think that this comes out of a New York, this one excerpt, I think that in any instruction that's given, it's important that the court point out the particular dangers of eyewitness identification. And I'll quote from a New York court instruction that's given. Quote, our system of justice is deeply concerned that no person who is innocent of a crime be convicted of it. In order to avoid that, a jury must consider identification testimony with great care, especially when the only evidence in identifying the defendant as a perpetrator comes from one witness. And that comes directly out of a New York model instruction that was referred to in one of the footnotes in Perry. Finally, justices, the prosecutor's office position is, I feel, instructive on why we need an appellate court statement on this issue in our state. If I interpret their position correctly, they feel that this type of instruction should almost never be given, or at least rarely be given. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I got out of the argument. So that underscores the importance and the reason why we need for this court to alter what is the current standard of discretion with the trial courts. Our attorneys face objections to this type of instruction by prosecutors every day, and it's very difficult to get trial courts to change behaviors that have been in place for many years, especially when there's a standard that's already in place. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tanaki, Mr. Tsushima. The court will take this matter under advisement. And at this time, on behalf of the court, I'd like to thank the students from Farrington and Mililani High Schools who joined us here today, as well as their outstanding teachers, Jennifer Hirotsu, Karen Nakasone, and Bruce Hirotsu of Farrington, and Amy Peruso and Jason Duncan of Mililani. The future of our system of government depends on the public's understanding of the Constitution and the protections it provides. And the commitment and hard work of these students demonstrates that we'll be in good hands going forward. I'd like to also acknowledge our many special guests and thank our partners in this effort here. Our special guests include many distinguished alumni of Farrington High School. We now have a number of attorneys here today who are Farrington graduates, including William Bagasol, William Domingo, Ronald Fujiwara, Michael Hare, Keith Kaneshiro, Emma Oshima, Clarence Picaro, Gary Sanaga,
Barry Soalo, and Thomas Yamachika. We have many other Farrington alumni here as well, including Skipper Diaz and his wife, Mary, officers and members of the Farrington Alumni and Community Foundation, including President David Jong, First Vice President Karen Hosaka, and her husband, Edwin Hosaka, and Treasurer Alice Nunagawa. We also have here from the court, of course, our colleague, Associate Justice Simeon Akoba, a 1962 graduate, as well as our judicial assistants, Grace Ganoza, and our public affairs officer, Marsha Kitagawa. We're honored to have today from the Schofield Barracks, the Legal Assistance Office, who's come to join us. We appreciate their presence. From the state legislature, we have Senator Donna Mercado Kim, Senator Clarence Nishihara, Representative Gilbert Keith Agaron, Representative Joey Monahan, Jessica Bursack from Corrine Ching's office, and Jennifer Higa, who's here on behalf of Representative Mark Takai. From elsewhere in our community, we have our retired Associate Justice from this court, Stephen Levinson, and the Hawaii State Bar Association President-elect, Quaig Wagnold. We also have representatives of the HSBA's Civil Education Committee, or Civic Education Committee here. We've had many partners who've helped us in making today's event possible. And they include the administration and staff here at Farrington, and I'd like to acknowledge them, particularly President Alfredo Carganilla, Vice Principal Daryl Ishihara, who oversees the Law and Justice Academy, where our Farrington students participate, Student Activities Coordinator Teresa Schubert Ellis, Assistant Student Activities Coordinator Ropati Liua, Head Custodian Jim Rath and his staff, Teacher Iva Tiave, the Farrington Security Team, and Brandon Chu, who provided IT and sound support. And I'd also like to acknowledge Mililani High School Principal John Brumell, who could not be here today. We have another very valued partner in this effort. That's the William S. Richardson School of Law, who helped us in the development of the curriculum and in helping the teachers and sharing with the students this case and giving them the opportunity to engage in practice arguments about this case. So they came here today with good knowledge of the case and what they were going to see. In particular, I'd like to thank Dean Avi Seufer, Dean Lori Tochiki, the Discover Law Grant, and the law students who helped those Farrington and Mililani students with their mock oral arguments in today's case. There are a number of them, but here in the audience today, we have Michelle Moorhead, who's the president of the Students for Public Outreach and Civic Education, Zach Delono, Justine Herrera, and Rick Macapinla. We also thank the Office of the Prosecuting Attorney, in particular Prosecutor Keith Kaneshiro, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Stephen Tsushima, and the Office of the Public Defender, and in particular Public Defender Jack Tanaki, for their cooperation. We deeply appreciate all those who've helped with us in this effort and all our special guests who've joined us today. If I've left anyone out, I very much regret it, but I want to thank you for your support. Once again, on behalf of the court, thank you and aloha for joining us here today. And at this time, the court will stand adjourned.
Please rise. This honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.
We're going to have a short recess at this time while we rearrange some of the furniture to get ready for the conclusion of the educational program that the students have been working very hard to prepare. So for members of the public and other individuals who are not a part of that educational program, you may now exit at this time. For those people who are a part of that educational program, please remain in the auditorium, which is now going to be back to an auditorium. So we'll just be back together in just a few minutes.